This is Bloomberg Best.
Bloomberg Best is about the insight and the context that we get from our guests.
It's a great way to catch up on some of the stories you might have missed on the Bloomberg.
Stories you're not going to find in any other news organization.
Bloomberg Best. Bloomberg's best stories of the day. Powered by 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries around the world.
I'm June Grosso. On this edition of Bloomberg Best for Monday, June 19th, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross discusses progress on a new NAFTA deal.
Once we have a new NAFTA, there's a pretty good chance that both the Canadian and the Mexican currencies will strengthen.
And Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg discusses the business climate in the United States.
We're already seeing real, tangible progress there. I think the great thing is, with President Trump and the administration, business has a seat at the table.
All this and more coming up in the next hour of Bloomberg Best.
President Trump has spoken at length about his business acumen and about how his administration would bring foreign investment into the country. Today, U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross made the case for investing in America at the Select USA Investment Summit. Just before the event, Ross spoke with Bloomberg's David Westin.
You're all talking about foreign companies, foreign investors investing in the United States. What is your main argument to them about why they should be investing in the United States right now, Mr. Secretary?
It's the same reason as American companies should be, and in fact are, namely regulatory reform, getting rid of red tape, tax reform, getting our rates down to very, very competitive levels, unleashing our energy resources, fixing our trade agreements, and creating a much more healthy environment for businesses and consumers.
So
all of those reasons are the why.
Excuse me. So let's talk about fixing those trade agreements. One of the things you mentioned, which comes within your purview. To what extent is fixing the trade agreements? You've been very outspoken. You want trade, but you want fair trade. To what extent do tightening up those trade arrangements encourage U.S. investment in the sense that people need to be here to manufacture so they're not subject to whatever restrictions there might be?
Well, I think it's a factor, but probably a relatively small factor. I think cutting the tax rates hugely, as we have planned to do, is a very, very big benefit. Our tax structure used to be a major disadvantage. Similarly, our regulatory structure had been a huge disadvantage. We were, I believe, the most overregulated country going. Well, when you're paying a lot of tax and you're having a lot of regulatory red tape, that discourages not only greenfield investment, it discourages any kind of investment in the country. So we think it's mostly a question of removing impediments and then coupling that with the normal benefits of the U.S., a huge population base, wonderful market, open access to it once you're here, highly educated workforce. Those are the kinds of fundamental factors that were always at work, but now are supplemented with the improvements in business climate created by President Trump.
Talk about the trade agreements again that you raise. Where are we right now? For example, let's be specific on NAFTA. We've talked about that before when you've been on the program. Where are we in the process of renegotiating NAFTA, and who's responsible? Is it you or is it your colleague, Bob Lighthizer?
Well, as to where we are right now awaiting the maturation of the 90-day letter that we're required under the Trade Promotion Act to send to the Congress. That clock ticks on the 18th of August. 30 days before that, we will be revealing to the Congress a more detailed negotiating strategy than we had discussed with them before. So the 18th of August is a big red-letter day for trade. But even short of that, we have a big day. Very soon, in the middle of July, is our next announcement period and next meeting session with the Chinese. As you know, we've accomplished quite a little bit ever since the detente at the Mar-a-Lago conference. And we're hoping to achieve still more deliverable items in the very, very near future.
So before we get to China, let's go back just for a moment to NAFTA. So you're saying mid-July, there's supposed to be a more detailed outline of the negotiating strategy of commerce than August 18, you really start the negotiations. Give us a sense after that. What is your hope on the timetable when you might have something concluded with the Mexican government and the Canadian?
Well, both governments are quite receptive to the idea of a renegotiation. They both know that this is, at best, an outdated agreement. It doesn't really address the digital economy. It doesn't very much address services in general. Certainly doesn't do much on financial services. Also doesn't do very much on natural resources. So those are some big gaping holes in it, in part because the Mexicans have changed their regulations for the better on natural resources, and in part because nobody way back when NAFTA was negotiated even knew there would be the digital economy. So first of all, it needs updating. Second of all, it needs some reprovisioning to adjust to the economic realities of today. So there are many things that need to be fixed, and I think everybody is up to the idea of fixing them.
That was U.S. Commerce Secretary Wilbur Ross speaking with Bloomberg's David Westin. Coming up, we'll speak exclusively with Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg. You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg. And now we're going to turn to the world of online advertising, an industry dominated by the Google-Facebook duopoly. For more, Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde spoke to Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg about the benefits of Facebook's mobile marketing businesses.
We think we offer a really unique value proposition for marketers and people because you can have the creativity of a video, the creativity of sound and light and pictures, but you can also do very specific targeting. You can target your current customers differently than new customers, people who are in the market for a car, people who look like people in the market for a car, so you can make sure the right message gets to the right person.
What are you expecting in terms of optimism from these sorts of businesses? Because are you seeing that the economy is going full pelt and the businesses and the brands are willing to spend the cash with Facebook at the moment, or is there slight nervousness out there?
Well, what we're seeing is more adoption of the mobile platforms. There are 70 million small businesses that are using Facebook on a monthly basis. That's our free product and 5 million advertisers. And on Instagram, we have 8 million Instagram business profiles, of which 1 million people are advertisers. And from the very smallest company to the largest company, they're investing in mobile because that's where people are spending their time.
And so do you feel optimistic about what these undercurrents show you about the U.S. economy, about the global economy in general? Are we seeing jobs being created? Are we seeing brands spending money and therefore willing to? Can you give us a gauge as an executive at the top of a business as to what you see out there?
Our goal is to make sure businesses spend money and get a return. So what matters for marketers is when they spend on marketing, it rings the cash register, both online and off. And that's something we're really working on. We also see small businesses playing a very important role in the global economy. The majority of job creation around the world is actually small businesses. And even the most offline small business can use the power of technology. When I was last in Europe, I went to Berlin. I got to visit a company called Holtz Connection. They're a furniture manufacturer in Berlin. They're manufacturing wooden furniture. So that is a very traditional business. The son came into the family business and didn't change anything about manufacturing, but started marketing on Facebook and through mobile. And they grew their business, and now they've opened 5 more locations, including outside of Germany, creating jobs and growing their business. And so technology can power innovation both in the core of a business, but also can support any business out there.
And so when people worry about perhaps tech eroding jobs out there, are you seeing the other point of view?
Technology is changing the economy. Technology is certainly replacing jobs, and technology can also be used to grow jobs. And it's our responsibility to help small businesses and large businesses all around the world use technology to grow their businesses so that they can grow jobs.
And interestingly, when of a current time when we're seeing perhaps drive towards job growth, we're also seeing valuations, for example, of technology companies go through volatile times. Does that ever affect you? Does it affect the way in which you look at the world?
My job every day is to work on growing Facebook, helping more people use Facebook and Instagram and Messenger and WhatsApp. More people get value from the products and services, and more businesses. And I feel like as a business leader, if I focus on our business, that's where my focus needs to stay.
And you talked there about responsibility of technology within the economy and small businesses. Talk to us also about the responsibility that you're going to talk about with brands at the moment, the brand safety element of all of this. How are we seeing in the news at the moment the very sad and emotive subjects such as fake news, hate speech, terror-related content? All of this is complex. All of this is so emotive, I realize. But how can you spearhead and target a way of looking through this with Facebook at the moment, not only for individuals, but also for brands?
There's no place for any of this content on Facebook. No place for hate, no place for violence, no place for terrorism. And we take that responsibility very seriously. We just announced last week, we've been working on this for a long time. We're going to continue to work on it. But we announced some really important next steps we're taking. We're using AI as a technology to help us find any content that may be inappropriate and get it off even faster. We're making a big human resource investment. We already have researchers and law enforcement experts and terrorism experts who work at Facebook, but we're growing that, as well as our human review capacity. We have about 4,500 people around the world who review content to remove inappropriate content, and we're growing that by 3,000, so that's a very significant investment. We're also working with nonprofits, governments, other companies around the world to make sure that we all work together to make sure that this content, you know, is not on our platforms. For brands, we offer a lot of tools for brands to know where their ads can show to make sure that they know that Facebook is a safe community for them.
That was Facebook COO Sheryl Sandberg speaking with Bloomberg's Caroline Hyde. Coming up, as Qatar continues to suffer under a Saudi-led blockade, we'll speak with the head of Qatar Airways. You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Quick Take. Context and background on issues of interest.
Our focus is on new mining ownership restrictions in South Africa with Bloomberg's Kevin Crowley.
The situation.
The ownership structure is not too dissimilar to where you would see elsewhere in the world. Where it does differ is that a portion of the local South African mining assets must be owned by black investors. And previously, this level was 26%, and now the government has raised that to 30%.
The background.
Well, the rules first came in around the early 2000s. And the intention was to transform the economy away from the traditional white ownership.
The argument.
The government believes that the mining industry has been far too slow to transform itself. The companies argue that they have done an enormous amount to increase black ownership, and they believe that continual dilution of their existing shareholders will lead to a lack of investment in the industry.
For more on South African mines or other quick takes, go to BloombergView.com, or for terminal customers, go to NI Quick. I'm Charlie Pallett, Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Best on Bloomberg Radio.
I'm June Grosso. Qatar Airways is calling for open skies after a Saudi-led blockade prevented the Gulf nation's national carrier from flying into its home territory. For more on how the blockade is affecting the airline, Bloomberg's Guy Johnson spoke with CEO Akbar Al-Bakar.
The world is not these four countries. We have a lot of new destinations that we are launching, and we will expedite those launches, and Qatar Airways will continue its growth path. We don't get intimidated, and we will find new markets, and there is many markets that are really longing for Qatar Airways to fly into their airports.
So, just in the near term, kind of what effect is it having operationally in terms of running the business?
Yes, it is having a lot of disruptive influence on our network, but we have successfully been mitigating this disruption. And we see already that there is an upward trend in the passengers that are now starting to book on Qatar Airways alone. Because normally the West think when there is a little bit upheaval, they think that it is a war zone. It is not a war zone, but it is just an intimidation game by our neighbors.
Are you not considering deferrals at the moment or cancellations? So there's no conversation happening?
Not at all. You can check with both Boeing and Airbus. We have not deferred any deliveries, and we are not going to do it because we are going to march on with our expansion.
Right. If you had to, so you're definitely not going to do that. If you had to, how many aircraft could you cancel? I understand, for instance, that the 350, you're only allowed to defer five.
As a matter of fact, we are not allowed contractually to defer anything because they are firm contracts, and we have no intention of deferring any of those aircraft deliveries. As a matter of fact, we are going to receive five 777s this year and 350s and eventually the Maxes.
Right. There's no politics involved in this. For instance, you wouldn't favor Airbus over Boeing. The President of the United States has sided with the Saudis. That wouldn't impact you in any shape or form.
Look, at the end of the day, President Trump is the leader of the largest power in the world today. I'm sure that his say in this matter will be very important, and I'm sure that at the end of the day, Trump will try to prevail to these warring individuals who have conflict to resolve their issues. I'm sure he will look what is justice to be done, and which is the villain and which is the persecuted, and he will make the right decision as the world's only superpower.
Okay. Before that happens, how long, do you see any light at the end of the tunnel? Do you see any inkling that this is going to end soon? Do you see this as a short-term problem, or are you planning it for it to be a long-term problem?
As far as I'm concerned, as an airline, we are always prepared for the worst. The rest I will leave it to the politicians, because I'm not a politician, so I really cannot predict anything.
Right. Can I just come back to the issue of how you're running the business operationally and what effect that it's having? You clearly have limited airspace that you can now operate in. How much is that increasing fuel costs? How much is it increasing transit time? Do some routes become non-viable as a result of that?
First of all, who told you that I have limited airspace?
Well, the Saudis, I understand.
Well, Saudi Arabia is not, the controller of the entire airspace in our region.
No.
We have large airspace open to us through the Iranian airspace.
Yep.
Though they mentioned that they have opened certain international routes for Qatar Airways, which is a lie, they haven't. They mentioned to ICAO that they have. Whilst we are applying to operate those routes, we are denied. But however, our business is as usual. We are flying all our flights over the Iranian airspace. And at the same time, we are mitigating the issue that we have with additional fuel consumption. And we are monitoring that very carefully and making sure that all our business streams are properly documented in order for us in the future to go to the international tribunals to reflect the pain that they have been put on flying additional hours onto our network.
That was Qatar Airways CEO Akbar Al-Bakar speaking with Bloomberg's Guy Johnson from the Paris Air Show. And coming up, we'll have more from the Paris Air Show with executives from Boeing and Airbus. You can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. This is Bloomberg.
This is a Bloomberg Business of Sports report. I'm Jeff Bellinger. The Federal Trade Commission is challenging the proposed merger between fantasy sports rivals DraftKings and FanDuel. The FTC says the combined company would control more than 90% of the U.S. market for paid daily fantasy sports contests. It is filing a complaint in federal court along with the attorneys general in California and Washington, seeking a preliminary injunction to stop the deal. According to the FTC's complaint, DraftKings and FanDuel are each other's most significant competitor. McDonald's is ending its sponsorship of the Olympic Games 3 years earlier than planned. That removes one of the event's biggest corporate partners at a time when its allure is fading. The International Olympic Committee and the fast food giant said on Friday they are terminating their worldwide partnership. McDonald's will continue to be a sponsor of the 2018 Winter Games in Korea, operating restaurants in the Olympic Park and Olympic Village. That's the Bloomberg Business of Sports Report. I'm Jeff Bellinger.
It's 48 minutes past the hour, and now it's time for Bloomberg View.
I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. Amazon, we all learned on Friday, is going to pay $13.7 billion to buy Whole Foods Market. You know what the Seattle company has spent even more money on over the past year? Research and development. Amazon's $17.4 billion in R&D spending has pushed it past automaker Volkswagen for first place among the world's corporations. Alphabet, Google's parent, is third. Intel is fourth. Samsung is fifth. Tech companies, automakers, and pharma companies fill the next 20 spots on the list. Amazon is a tech company selling both products such as Echo speakers and services such as its cloud computing platform. It's also an online retailer of others' products. It's a media company. Now it's going to be an organic grocer. Which industry do you think it will spend its way into next? I'm Justin Fox, a columnist for Bloomberg View. For more Bloomberg opinion and commentary, please go to BloombergView.com or View Go on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Thanks, Justin. And now let's check in with the Bloomberg affiliates to find out what's happening on the nation's most influential radio stations.
I'm Elisa Parenti. On WBBM in Chicago, Boeing is off to a stellar showing at the Paris Auto Show, wrapping up commitments worth roughly $30 billion worth of planes.
I'm Courtney Donahoe on WHAS in Louisville. What the Amazon Whole Foods deal means for the future of Kroger.
I'm Larry Kofsky, and on Bloomberg 99.1 in Washington, I'm reporting on a Supreme Court trademark ruling that could impact the Washington Redskins.
This is Charlie Pellet, and on 1010 Winds in New York, I'm keeping an eye on the Blue Apron IPO.
Thank you, Charlie. And now we're going to get back to the Paris Air Show, where Boeing and Airbus continue to fight for dominance as the world's most popular aircraft manufacturer. Bloomberg has been speaking with the CEOs of both companies, and we'll begin with Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg. He spoke with Bloomberg's Guy Johnson.
We're continuing to see strong energy in the marketplace. You know, we've got a $7.5 trillion market over the next 10 years. The orders flow in commercial airplanes remain steady. We're expecting a book-to-bill again this year of about one.
Right.
And we've got about 5,700 commercial airplanes in backlog, about 7 years of production backlog. So that long-term backlog really gives strength to the marketplace, strength to our operations.
And you sense that this show is going to deliver more as well?
Yeah, I think so. We've seen a lot of narrow-body interest. So, of course, this week we'll be highlighting the MAX family.
Yep.
We've got the 737 MAX 9 flying. And also we're seeing some good incremental wide-body opportunities, 787s and 777s.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the MAXs for a moment. As you say, 8's in operation, got the 9 here. We're waiting for the bell to be rung on the arrival of the 10, which is the news you're going to deliver for us, we think, a little bit later on. The question surrounding the 10 is, and we talked to a lot of your customers, they wanted the 10 for a while. So here's the question, why has it taken you so long to respond to an A321neo that has been flying out of the door? Could you have had this earlier?
Now, we actually think the timing is just right. If you look at the heart of the market for narrow bodies, the MAX 8 and MAX 9 continue to be in the heart of the market. We got about 4,000 737s in backlog.
Right.
And because of that, we're ramping up from 42 a month production rate right now to 57 a month in 2019. The MAX 10 is going to add to that. We think the timing is just right. But even against this current production profile ramp up, we're oversold. So I think the timing in the marketplace is good. We'll have the MAX 10 available to get into the marketplace around 2020, and we think that's going to add long-term value for our customers.
Do you think people will flip from the 9 to the 10? I imagine the engineering challenge around that's not particularly difficult. Do you think it may end up cannibalizing some of the 9?
Now, we'll likely have some conversions, as is normal. We'll have some incremental orders as well, and you'll see it adding to the family. The key is we have a family approach to how we design airplanes. And when our customers can operate across the MAX 7, 8, 9, and 10, that adds value for their operations.
Let's talk about another aircraft. I think Steve Harsey's called it the 797. I've heard 7M7. Yeah. I think you call it the NMA. I've heard MUM, yeah. Middle of market.
Yeah.
This is the kind of 6-7, 767 replacement aircraft.
Yeah.
A lot of people are talking about it. When do you think you guys are going to have board sign-off on that?
Yeah, well, we're going to talk some more this week about the market interest. So right now we're in the phase of evaluating the market, talking to our customers. We've talked literally to dozens of customers to gauge their interest in this middle of the market space. We see a need for an airplane that's larger than the 757 in terms of passenger count and longer range, probably about a 5,000 nautical mile kind of airplane, 250 passenger seats, rough order of magnitude.
Twin aisle.
Potentially a twin aisle solution. We're looking at different options for how we'd satisfy it. Really important that right now we focus on knowing what our customers are looking for, evaluating the market, making the business case work. But we see a potential market there for about 4,000 aircraft. So we're going to do our due diligence. We have time to make the right decision. If we do this airplane, it will be 2024, 2025 entry into service. So we have time to do it right. And if we were to do this development program, it would be on the backside of 777X. So it would feather in nicely to our R&D plans.
Let's talk politics. Qatar, first of all, the president has sided on the Saudi side of the fence. We're 3 weeks into this. Clearly, Qatar Airways is having to make some really significant changes. Do you think that there is the potential for cancellations, deferrals? We're going to talk to Mr. Al-Bakr a little bit later on. How closely are you monitoring that, and could it be a problem?
Well, we're keeping a very close eye on the situation. Obviously, the relationship between the United States and Qatar is very important. More broadly, the Middle East region, where we have a number of customers on both the defense and the commercial side. Our customers at Qatar Airways are extremely important to us. We do have significant backlog there.
Yep.
But we're seeing some stability there. And we think in the long run, that relationship will be worked out. I think, you know, a very good signpost last week with the U.S. government signing the deal for F-15s with Qatar just gives you a sense that at the foundation level, the relationship is strong. There's some issues to work through, but we're very hopeful that the country-to-country relationship will remain solid, and we know we have an important role to play in that. We're going to continue to serve our customers on both the commercial and defense side.
That was Boeing CEO Dennis Muilenburg. And now we're going to move on to Boeing's chief competitor, Airbus. CEO Tom Enders also spoke with Bloomberg's Guy Johnson from the Paris Air Show.
Let's talk about the 380 Plus. This is a 380. It's got new wings, new winglets, I guess I should probably say. That improves, as far as I understand, fuel burn by around 4%.
Yeah, that's correct.
What can you squeeze out of the engine, guys, to get it up to, say, the, I don't know, let's say 7-8% fuel efficiency that maybe you need to get Tim Clark on board?
Well, we'll see. I mean, we have constant improvements on the engine, but now is a... was a time to make an improvement through the aerodynamics, the winglet. As you say, 4%. Even before the 4%, that was already the most fuel-efficient aircraft. With the 4%, with the improvements, by the way, also on the cabin, the ability to seat an additional 80 passengers more, this is by far the most competitive wide-body aircraft.
But if you don't want the density increase, is there anything more that you think you'll be able to do?
Oh, there's plenty of ideas, but that is something that we discuss individually with the airlines.
Do you think, are we getting close to the kind of numbers that Tim will be looking for, do you think, over at Emirates? That's always a moving feast, I'm sure.
We're going to see. I mean, we're going to see. This is an ongoing discussion, as you know. This aircraft works beautifully for Emirates, quite obviously. I think we'll have the 100th A380 that we delivered this year to Emirates, so that that speaks for itself. And certainly, the name of the game is to continuously improve these aircraft for our customers, and we're heavily engaged in that right now.
You talked about the A321neo being in a class of its own. That's your view. Boeing's looking at the middle of the market. Do you think that the 321neo will compete in that middle of the market area, or do you think Boeing will actually be able to take some interesting routes there?
Well, they seem to have a problem in the middle of a market. We don't. We have two very competitive aircraft there. One, as you mentioned, the 321, up to 230, 235 seats. And then, from next year onwards, we'll have the 330neo, a very competitive beast. It starts basically at 250 passenger seats with a very, very state-of-the-art engine. Low capital cost, very, very competitive. We feel good about the middle of the market, I tell you.
Okay, some very quick questions. Do you think you're going to see deferrals out of the Gulf as a result of what's happening with Qatar?
I mean, the development is certainly worrying. We very much hope, like anybody else in the industry, that this is a temporary hiccup over there. But I'm not going to speculate about about further deferrals or cancellations. We'll see. We're in good discussion with the airlines concerned.
How are you going to manage the transition from your sales supremo, John Leahy, to Kieran Rao? That's going to be a tricky one.
Look, I mean, obviously, I think John is 66 now, 67.
Yeah.
Even if John Leahy will retire at some point, I mean, we have to allow that happening. But John prepared his succession over the last couple of years, yep, very, very professionally. So I have no doubt that this transition, when it happens, will happen extremely smoothly. And Kieran Rao is a very, very experienced sales executive.
That was Airbus CEO Tom Enders speaking with Bloomberg's Guy Johnson. That's all for this edition of Bloomberg Best. If you have a Bloomberg terminal, you can see all the Bloomberg Best stories at Best Go. Our show is produced by David Sucherman, Clarice Brough, and Reginald Bazile. I'm June Grosso. This is Bloomberg.